Sylvia and me.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, I'm Wendy Walker. I'm the author of Deep Dark Psychological Thrillers, and I am here with Sylvia and me.
Wendy, welcome to our podcast today. And when you say you're the author of Deep Psychological Thrillers, boy, do you mean it. We have The Night Before, which is online dating, attachment disorder, Emma in the Night, All Is Not Forgotten. We have narcissism. We have memory. We have so much. And we'll get into a lot of that in just a little bit. But what I want to do is I want to go back to dreams. You had some dreams that you started off, and I believe it started maybe with figure skating.
Yeah, I actually wanted to be an Olympic figure skater. I started training around 7 or 8 years old, which was actually late to get started. And I took to it immediately. And I was incredibly dedicated to it until I stopped skating at 16. And there was a stretch where I showed a lot of potential and was actually able to go to Colorado Springs and train in a very famous Olympic training center there.
Wow. So figure skater. And then your next journey was in the finance?
It was. So when I left figure skating, I needed a new dream, of course, because I was a very driven young woman. And I decided that I wanted to be very successful at something very difficult. And I don't know how I latched on to banking and investment banking, but I did love math and economics. And so I really studied and made my college experience geared towards the financial industries and was successful in getting a job after college. So that was my next big adventure.
And then you had another adventure after that.
Yeah, this one wasn't quite so drastic, but I decided while I was working on Wall Street that I wanted to do something that was more geared towards social justice and social causes. And so I went to law school, not knowing exactly what I was going to do, but I was very drawn to women's issues and also to criminal law. So I went to Georgetown and went to law school and then practiced law.
So you were you had dreams of an Olympic figure skater. You worked in the financial industry. Then you went to law school and family law. And in between that, you got married and you have 3 boys, I believe.
Yes. So I found myself, ironically, back in this suburban community where I had grown up. And I was a stay-home mom for about 14 years. And it was really interesting because I think after all of that dream chasing, I really wanted to hunker down and have the dream of raising a family. I was very fortunate to be able to do that. It was something that I just felt it was time to do. And it was an amazing experience.
Okay. Next on your list was author?
Yes. So while I was home with my kids, I found myself going a little bit stir crazy. I found it very difficult to put aside all of the chasing of dreams that I had gotten very used to. And it was almost like my whole central nervous system was not happy with this lifestyle. And I knew that if I didn't find something to do for myself that had an end goal and that had some ambition attached to it, that I was going to start living through my children, which I knew I was not supposed to be doing if I was going to actually be a good stay-at-home mom or mom at all. So it just popped into my head that I would try to write. And what's interesting when I look back on it, because people always say, oh, have you always wanted to be a writer? And I didn't always want to be a writer, but it was really interesting when I slowed down and there was no no other choice in front of me. That was sort of an obvious thing to do because I didn't want to go back into the paid workforce where I had to leave my kids. That this is what I came up with, not to be an artist, not to do volunteer work, but to write a novel. And I think it must have been somewhere inside of me all that time because it really was the first thing that came to me.
Were you a voracious reader when you were a child?
I was, actually. And then when I got older, I started really focusing on my dreams. And so I started reading more nonfiction and business books. And in law school, there's so much reading. I didn't do any pleasure reading at all in law school. But when I went back to work and there was commuting and I had more time, I did start reading again. And I was very drawn to legal thrillers. And I think I don't love writing as much as I love storytelling. I enjoy the process of, you know, of finding an interesting way to tell a story and put it down on the page. But what I really love is thinking about the stories. And I realized that I had gone through most of my life accumulating these vignettes that I would think, wow, that would be great in a book or a movie, or it should be part of a bigger story, this little moment that I've experienced in my real life.
And so you started writing. You had the three boys that you were taking care of. You didn't, you put out a couple of books. How did you finally get your first book together? And what did it feel like when you said, oh, it's done, and then you had to find someone to publish it?
So, well, it was a really long journey, actually. When I started writing a legal thriller, and that book will never see the light of day. It's so outdated now. There were actually, you know, surveillance that was done on like VCR tapes. Before cell phones were really common. I mean, it was, you know, back in the dark ages. But I wrote that book without taking any classes on how to write a novel. And so when I finished it, my youngest son was not, I think I was pregnant with him, and I really didn't know what to do with this novel. And I brought it to a writing professor who told me I had a great plot, but I did not know how to write a novel. Note to self, maybe take a class first when you make a drastic pivot in your life. But I kind of knew that about myself, that I knew how to structure a story, and I'm a good writer, but I didn't know how to write a novel. I could write a legal brief. I could write a business proposal. So he gave me a crash course in how to use dialogue and narration and choose a narration structure and how to always think about what the reader is experiencing. And so I rewrote that book with his help, and I learned how to write. It was a crash course, and I was able then to get an agent from that book. And then I quickly wrote another book, and that was the first one that was published.
And what was that called?
So that book was called Four Wives, and it was about four wives in suburban Connecticut. It was very much in the general fiction category. It was not a thriller, although I like to think it's exciting. And I published that book, and then another one followed with the same publisher, called Social Lives. And those two books are very dear to my heart, but they did not sell well. So I thank all my friends and family who bought copies.
Well, I bought copies, and I read both of them. I thought they were a typical suburban, basically New England, and they were great, almost like Stepford Wives. There was something
yes.
about them. So they were pretty good as far as I was concerned. And that got me into reading, you know, knowing what you did. But then you took a complete pivot.
Yeah. So at that time, I mean, it was thrilling to get published. But around the same time, I was also getting divorced. So it will always be tied up with that emotional upheaval in my life. And after my divorce, I gave it a couple more years to see if I could get my career off the ground. And I edited for Chicken Soup for the Soul. I looked for freelance work as a writer. And I just realized that I was going to have a better career path going back to the law. And my kids were all in school by then. So I went back to practicing law and found work in family law. And so I had stopped writing, actually, and I was quite content being a sort of two-thirds time family lawyer. But it came back. The thought that I wasn't quite done with this dream came back into my mind. And it was not, you know, an overnight success. I wrote a whole other book about women and a family and more, you know, again, general fiction. And I was able to find a new agent with that book. But we didn't sell that book, and she never even brought it to market because she didn't think there was a market for it at the time. And that was when I really almost stopped, because I was practicing law, raising my kids, and trying to write on this side. And so I came back to her and I said, look, I'm going to write one more book, and I want to do everything right. And if this book doesn't sell, then I really need to be done with this dream. And then she said, well, the market really wants the next Gone Girl. They want psychological thrillers, unreliable narrators. So I didn't even know what that was. I had to do some research, and I took an idea that I'd had from years before, and I wrote All Is Not Forgotten in about 2 months. I took time off from my legal practice, and that book, it was like a watershed. The skies opened. I had bidding wars and movie deals and foreign contracts. And that was 4 years ago.
So you didn't let somebody saying, oh, this isn't really what the market wants. It's not going to sell. I'm not even going to put it out there. You didn't let that stop you. What you actually did was you took what they said is what the supply is, what the demand is for, what right. The genre is, and you went and you dug deeper.
I did. This is how I felt about it. I felt that I needed an answer to the question of whether or not I should stop pursuing this dream. Because the reality, and it's very hard to say this as a mother, because you want to tell your kids, just you can do anything you want, you have any dream you want, be anything you want. But as a grown-up, you realize that some dreams are not going to come true. And I always joke that, I can't start doing cartwheels in my living room and say I'm going to be an Olympic gymnast. That's never going to happen. I'm 52. That dream is never coming true. Even if I did have it, I couldn't go back to figure skating. So I think that what happened when I gave up figure skating really informed my decisions for the rest of my life. And not never more than that moment when I needed an answer about whether to keep pursuing this dream of being an author. So I needed to create a universe for myself that would give me the answer. And because I'm very practical and logical and business-minded, I decided to construct this scenario where I had done everything right. I had a great agent. I was going to write to the market. I was going to study what people were loving to read, find the biggest opening which I could go through to get through those gatekeepers. And then I sat down and didn't read any other work. I just wrote from my gut in the most original way that I could with this story that had been in my mind for many years. And it just all came together. And thankfully the answer was, yes, you can be a writer.
That's great. And as I started off, you have tackled real life issues in your books, in the psychological yes. thriller. So tell me, the first psychological thriller that you put out, exactly what was it that precipitated that? What event, what friend, what event precipitated using that particular, what was the psychology behind it?
So All Is Not Forgotten the began with an article in the New York Times that I read back in 2011 about memory science. And that really came from my experience as an attorney, my involvement with women's issues over the years, and some experiences I had actually when I was training for figure skating out in Colorado, and involving sexual assault and other things affecting girls. that had always really stayed with me. And actually, Ashley Wagner, who's an Olympic figure skater, recently came out with a story that of something that happened to her at the same training facility I was at. And it was shocking to read it because it really was quite rampant when I was there. And just the sexual misconduct that went on, and the young girls with the older boys and young men. It was extremely prevalent when I was there. And back in the 80s, nobody thought twice about these things. That always stayed with me, experiencing that as a young girl. So these two things combined, this article I'd read in the New York Times about memory science and the thought that one day we might be able to change our memory of a traumatic event, and this knowledge of what sexual assault is about, and sort of a deep concern and social concern about these issues. And I put those two things together to write All Is Not Forgotten, which involves the erasing of a memory in a teenage girl who's been sexually assaulted.
And that was written how many years ago?
4 years ago.
Before the Me Too.
Way before Me Too, yeah. Before that, it was the book. It was actually before the woman was assaulted on the campus of Stanford University, who had no memory of her attack because she was unconscious. That came out after the book was written, and it dovetailed with it. I remember reading the letter that she wrote to the judge describing her emotional trauma, even though she had no factual memory. She still had emotional trauma, just knowing what had happened to her and having the events described to her.
And that's what people don't understand. Just because you don't physically remember it, when someone is relating to you what the trauma, you know, describing that trauma to you, there is huge emotional trauma that takes place. And people disregard that. And so you tackled that way before it was a well-known issue. And then you went on to do Emma in the Night.
Yeah, so Emma in the Night really was born from my fascination with what we call access to disorders. And I learned about them while I was a divorce attorney. And so that period of my life has come in very handy because I was trained to be a guardian ad litem for children. And in that training, we learned a lot about these disorders. And narcissistic personality disorder is one of them. And I remember learning about it and thinking, wow, most people don't know what a narcissist truly is and what lies beneath the surface and what the psychology of it and the genesis of it is. And so I really wanted to explore that. And I constructed Emma in the Night in a way that would really bring that home and try to really capture what it's like to grow up the child of a narcissist. So I did a lot of research into that and read a lot of blogs and letters and other things I could find on the internet from children of narcissists, and tried to really, you know, bring that to life in the book.
So you've taken some of your dreams, your figure skating, that helped you with Emma in the Night. With All Is Not Forgotten. Mm-hmm. And then you're legal.
Right.
Okay. So your next book, The Night Before, yeah. What dream period was that?
Okay. So then The Night Before, I finally decided to write about deception in internet dating. And it was a tough decision to do that because I don't like to be public with my private life. But I have been single for 11 years. I have done internet dating in between relationships. And I have a lot of single friends now who have ventured out into internet dating. It's much more prevalent than it ever was before. And with all the apps, it has completely changed the landscape of dating. And I just really wanted to capture what it feels like to be deceived in that way, because there is there is this intimacy about it when you start texting with someone that you've met on an app or online, and it's intimate, not sexually intimate, but it becomes emotionally intimate pretty quickly.
Very much.
Because you're both already saying, I like you. So you've already skipped over that part where you have a conversation or get to know someone in person and decide you like them. You've decided you like them from two pictures and a few things they've said. And immediately you're interfacing with them on whatever platform you're on about your personal life, and they're making jokes and telling you you have a beautiful smile and you're so sexy or whatever it is they're saying. And then the next thing you know, you're on a date, and it's like you've skipped over so much of the due diligence that we normally would do if we were just meeting people in person. And you go into that bar, into that restaurant, already feeling an attachment to that person, already feeling a level of trust because you've exchanged these text messages. And then to find out that that person lied to you about something, sometimes it's just what they look like or whether they have a job, but sometimes it's something as important as whether they're still married.
Exactly. And the thing is that even though we're told about the rules about what we should be doing, that you just go in and you make sure you just have a cup of coffee, the disappointment that can take place just from what someone looks like, you can sometimes put that aside because you've spent all this time right. with the relationship, in quotes, with, you know, the time texting and maybe talking on the phone, that you don't want to think that you were fooled. So right. you might talk yourself into not listening to your gut.
Right. And it's also become a candy store.
Yes.
And a man actually said that to me. We were talking, having the, you know, obligatory phone conversation before meeting. And he was describing to me how it was like a candy store when he first got divorced and went on Bumble. And I thought, yeah, that's what it's like, because every day you get anywhere from 10 to 100 more people to look at and swipe left or right on. And then you can have pages and pages or screens and screens of face bubbles of people you've matched with. And so if you don't like the answer to something someone's told you, or they don't like your answer, that, you know, just there's somebody else who's right there. And if you're in a relationship, this is the thing I found. I won't tell the whole long story, but there was a man that I encountered on Bumble, and I recognized him, and I couldn't figure out from where. He did not recognize me, and it turned out we were friends on Facebook. I have a lot of Facebook friends because I promote for my books right. on Facebook. So a lot of them are just friends of friends, people I don't really know well, but we're in the same community. And so I was able to find him on Facebook, and when I went on his page, he has a serious girlfriend. They've been together for over a year, it looked like, from the pictures, traveling around. And he was using a different name on Bumble because, you know, he obviously didn't want to be discovered. But I thought, wow, like, this woman has no idea. She thinks they're happy. There was a picture of them out together the same day. Out on a date, and, you know, he tagged it like, oh, here with my love or something like that. She's smiling, this huge smile. And I remember thinking, like, she has no idea that he's back in the candy store. And who knows, maybe he doesn't like, you know, the way she cooks, or maybe he's not getting along with one of her kids, or maybe he doesn't like her dog. And he's like, oh, maybe I can find somebody just like her who doesn't have a dog or doesn't have kids or, you know,
and they'll make it so that when they do find someone else, then they'll get ready. You know,
yeah.
It's like having somebody, you know, in the wings,
right?
So that you're not alone. And it's awful.
Yeah.
But people are really, really stupid when they really think that.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people are do their due diligence.
They do,
and you have to.
But, you know, here was this woman. I'm sure she's been dating this man for a year.
And she trusts him.
And she trusts him. Mm-hmm. And how are you going to know? You can't go on Bumble and Tinder and search for people
no.
the way you can on some of the other platforms. And so if that person, you know, finds a way to put in criteria that will probably not match yours, they can find a way to not show up on your screen. So it's really a changing the landscape of dating and relationships. But with the book, what I really wanted to do was not focus on victimization, but rather to have a little fun with it.
You did.
So I thought, well, what if you took, and it could be a woman too. Women do this to men. So
yes,
this is not gender stereotyping at all. But in this book, it's a woman. And I thought, well, what if the man who's lying chooses the wrong woman to lie to? And what if she's a little bit of a tinderbox and she's been lied to one too many times and she's not going to take this lightly if she finds out on this date that he has lied to her? And so I gave her a backstory that supported that. And hopefully it's a book that women can identify with, not only for the internet dating, but also because she's just frustrated at always choosing the wrong men and not being able to figure out why and not being able to turn the ship around. So it goes into attachment disorders, why we choose the wrong men over and over, and how we can break the cycle. All in the context of a really exciting thriller.
And it is an exciting thriller. As we've talked about, your dreams have really helped you with each other step that you're doing, especially
yes.
what you're doing now with your career. And I believe that The Night Before has even been optioned by...
Yes.
By tell us
Ava Longoria, who's an amazing producer now. She's got a production company and she's really, really killing it right now in Hollywood.
So you've persevered. You've known that there are certain things that you want to do, and you didn't let anyone tell you you couldn't. The only person that you let was really you.
Yeah.
Yes, one of the agents said, no, this is not going to work, but then you went to figure out what could work. And they
right.
told you, and you went forward with it. So what kind of advice would you give to, women who have been, maybe they've been beaten down, or maybe they're just tired. They have some, something that they've thought of doing, but they put it off and put it off.
Yeah. I think what I've learned, hands down, is that we all have resources that we don't really fully appreciate. We have friends that know friends, and we have networks of people. We have skills that we've acquired. What was so interesting when I went to practice divorce law, I had not practiced law for 14 years, and I when I went back into it, I canvassed all of the people I knew that were lawyers. And that's how I got back into the law. A friend of mine I hadn't been in touch with for many years was a divorce lawyer, and he knew someone at Legal Services in downtown Stamford. And they took me on as a volunteer so I could get retrained. And that that woman who ran the organization, she knew everybody in family law. And when this job opportunity came up, she suggested me for it, and I interviewed. So all of that happened from me just going into my virtual Rolodex, if you will, and trying to network. And what is so interesting as well is that I had not thought about doing family law before, but it was the perfect fit because I had life skills that were incredibly valuable to my clients. So I needed to learn the law. I didn't know, the
right.
nuts and bolts of the law or the procedures, but I knew how much travel soccer cost. I knew how much, it cost to clean up your yard if you had 2 acres and lived in the woods. I knew what a parenting plan looked like. I had this life experience from raising children in Fairfield County and from being a single mom.
Right.
that I could bring to the table, and it was incredibly valuable. Who would have thought that that would have been, a skill set that would actually have unique value in a field of law?
But people, our life skills, everyone has life skills,
right.
and what happens is we don't appreciate what we have. And that, to me, is we're putting ourselves down instead of digging in and realizing, when people say to me, well, I can't go back into the workforce, I'm too old, no one's going to, I don't know what to put down. Well, take a look at what you've done.
Right.
In raising a family or taking care of a house or, you know, any of the above and all of the above,
right,
they are broken down into life skills. Everything, whether it's organizing, whether it's dealing with a construction, a plumber, or some kind of, you know, trauma, it's a life skill that we do acquire. And you've used it.
Yeah.
So kudos.
Thank you.
And I understand you're working on your next book, which unfortunately won't be out for a year from September, you told
me. Yeah, that one's actually done. And I just started a fifth thriller, but the fourth will, it's called Don't Look for Me, and it's coming out in September of 2020. And it's about a woman who's abducted in a very small, desolate town in upstate Connecticut, and she's abducted to care for a young girl who has also been a prisoner in the house, although she doesn't know it. She was born in the house and has never left. So it's sort of Misery meets Room. It's got a Stephen King kind of feel to it, a little bit, not full on horror type of story. There's nothing gory or gruesome in it, but it has that feel to it, that sort of atmospheric, creepy feel, which was a lot of fun to write.
Well, I look forward to that, definitely. Wendy, again, thank you. This has been great. And I look forward to the next one. And again, people, you have dreams. Just go forward. Don't put everything behind. And Wendy, again, thank you.
Thank you.
To find out more about Wendy and her books, visit wendywalkerbooks.com. Thank you for joining me today. On our next podcast, I'll be talking with another extraordinary woman. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, iHeartRadio, and of course, our website, lifeapray.com. Listen, subscribe for free, and take us with you wherever you are. This has been a Life of Prey production.